Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Stuart Thompson. Welcome to Personal Transformation. Well, tonight, I'm not broadcasting from the gatehouse, but I am broadcasting from my very comfortable red leather couch in my basement. Folks, tonight, that's what I'm doing. But what I'm doing here tonight is I'm doing a repodcast of... I had a guest here on April the 12th, which was a couple of weeks ago, and unfortunately, I had some technical problems. So tonight, what I would like to do is I really want to pay homage to Michael for coming in, because he is a survivor of sexual abuse, and he really, really did a good job about talking about his story and what he does about it for the Canadian Center for Men and Families, and which is located in Toronto. And anyway, I just want to do him justice by rebroadcasting this. So I'm really, really hoping my second recording that I had will be suffice that you can understand it. I am a little concerned, but all the more reason after losing this the last time I tried to do this. But sometimes doing this sort of thing, we do have technical difficulties. And unfortunately, with the digital age through the internet, well, versus the old way, which would be the analog way, which would be through the airwaves, I'd probably have a better chance of doing it. And then again, the probability of something happening there too is always possible too. As long as you don't have power, you can't do anything. Anyway, enough of that. Anyway, my story is tonight is I'm back to men and talking about their sexual abuse. Like I say, this was broadcasted on April the 12th. And wasn't broadcasted. I did pick it up, though, on Periscope. And this is where I have my audio recording, not just visual, but I have an audio recording of our conversation. And I would encourage you just to listen in, and hopefully you get some really, really good insight. Michael is very, very insightful, and he has lots of really, really good things to say, and he has lots to share, and especially what the Canadian Center does. I will elaborate more on what the Center does after he's done talking, so it'll be about an hour and 30 that he's talking, with some interjection between the both of us as well. So I do hope you enjoy the conversation, and I hope the quality as well. So just give me a moment here. I'm going to get set up, and I'm going to get this going. Here we go, and
good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Personal Transformation. My name is Stuart Thompson, and with me tonight, I have Blair. Michael Healy is what I'm trying to say. What I was thinking about was my last facilitator, and this first name happened to be Blair. But why I thought that, I have no idea. But I apologize. My guest tonight is Michael Healy from the Canadian Center of Men and Families. And first off, I got a couple things I want to say before we get into this interview. I don't know if you can wave here on there as well, Michael.
Hello.
So we're kind of doing it in a double platform here. We are broadcasting through Periscope, and we're also broadcasting through Blog Talk Radio, which is called Personal Transformation. So good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We have quite a good topic to talk about tonight, mainly men for change. And we have a lot of good information we're going to pass on to you. But first, I want to get a couple things out of the way. One of them, first off the bat, which is very most important, I am not a therapist or a doctor or anything like that. I'm only here offering my own experiences, and I'm not here to tell you what you should or shouldn't do. So whatever you hear tonight and you decide you want to do for yourself, it'll be all on your own cause. So folks, tonight, welcome, Michael.
Great. Thanks, sir. Thanks for having me here.
So I guess right off the hop, now, I know in the beginning we talked, you want to start with a message before we get going.
Yeah, a couple of things I would like to say. Firstly, just let the audience know that I'm here. I work as a volunteer with the Canadian Center for Men and Families, and it's an agency that's located, or at least the main part of the agency is located in Toronto. But they do have services and offices and branches throughout Canada. And so I'll talk a little bit more about some of the services that they offer, but the specific thing that I came here tonight to talk about was men who have experienced domestic violence, and what I mean experienced that have been on the receiving end of that violence. And so my message I'd like to start with for people listening here is that men are abused. I know there's statistics out there that we get inundated in the media, and I'll talk more about some of the statistics a little bit later, but some of the statistics we hear are that 85% of the victims of domestic violence are women, etc. And as I said, I'll get into those. But even notwithstanding, if you take those numbers, the reality is that there are men who are victims of domestic violence and domestic abuse. And I'm actually going to use three definitions that I'm going to just call it domestic abuse tonight, but I'll give you the three definitions. One is domestic violence, and that's when there's actually physical violence in a relationship, in a domestic relationship. There's domestic abuse, which is a little bit more of a catch-all, so it includes violence, but it also includes psychological abuse, things like manipulation. But the word domestic abuse also includes people who are just observing it, so they may not be the victim of the actual abuse, but an example of that would be children in relationships. And the third one is called intimate partner violence, which is similar types of behaviors, what could be abuse or violence, but it's when those people are not living together or cohabitating. And so those three terms kind of catch everything, and I'm just going to use the term domestic abuse here tonight, but know when I say that I'm talking about all three of those types of situations. So my message, my main message tonight is, firstly, that even though I'm here talking about men and men being experiencing abuse, I in no way want to take away from women's experience of abuse as well. Abuse is just horrendous no matter who it happens to. And men are, because of some of the numbers that are out there, sort of men are underserved. And part of the agency, the Canadian Centre for Men and Families, is they wanted to look at gaps in services and fill those gaps. And one of the gaps that they saw was that there were men who were being abused and there weren't any services for those men or nowhere for those men to go. And I'll talk a little bit more about that and when I talk about my experience as well. So if you're listening to this program, and anything that I speak about tonight, because I will talk about what abuse looks like and what some of the problems of abuse are, if any of this you hear and it's happening to you or it's happening to someone that you know, I'm going to encourage you to seek help, either for yourself or for that person, or have a conversation with them, get them to seek help. It's one of the real issues, particularly for men, and I'm not saying it's not for women, but particularly for men, is in not just in the area of domestic abuse, but in all areas, men tend to seek help less than women. We hold it in, we don't tell people, we don't talk about it. There's many reasons for that. It could be socialization, you know, societal beliefs about it, etc. But I just encourage you, whether male, female, whatever the gender, if anything that I'm talking about tonight or we're talking about here resonates and you see it or heard it, find a way to get some help. Because the sooner one can get help, the less likely that mitigate the long-term effects. So that's my message.
Thank you. So, Michael, now you're a part of this organization. Can I ask you what brought you to do this sort of thing, or your story, what brought you to do this?
Yeah. And so I want to tell a few parts of that story.
Sure.
And some of it has to do with how I got to the Canadian Centre for Men and Families. Well, I'll just talk a little bit kind of give you an overview of what the abuse looked like for me or my situation. And I also have to say that when I talk about this is that the other part that we're talking about at Canadian Centre for Men and Families is one of the programs that they offer for men who have experienced domestic violence and domestic abuse is a group program. It's a peer-led. I do some of the peer leading of that group, and it's a 12-week-long program. And so some of what I'll talk about tonight also is kind of drawing on my experiences from what some of the men in those groups share. Obviously, I'm not going to share any confidences that, that they've shared that I haven't already gotten clearance for. Won't use any names, anything like that, but just talk a little bit about some of that experience. So what brought me to the center, how I got there, was I was in a relationship that ultimately ended up being very abusive physically, psychologically, emotionally, And I want to speak a little bit about what abuse is before I get too far into it. And abuse can be not just only physical, so hitting and kicking and punching and throwing things and weapons, but it can also be psychological and manipulation. It can be financial, controlling the finances. It can be social, and that they might, an abuser might threaten or actually do reveal information about you that was intimate and shared in a private setting with your family or friends. So there's lots of different ways that abuse can happen. Even something, sexual abuse, and that does happen to men. Men can be forced into doing sexual acts against their will or that makes them uncomfortable. That's sexual abuse. It happens within relationships. All of those things are part of it. And there's also often a pattern of how that abuse develops. Because one of the questions that I often get when I tell my story, and so I'm going to talk about it up front, is, well, why did you leave? And there's a lot of reasons why, and some of them have to do with my own psychology, my own makeup, and my own history, and what I was wanting to get from the relationship. And some of them just have to do with the way the pattern of these relationships evolved. It didn't start out with hitting right in the very beginning or any physical violence. I was in the relationship for 5 years, and the physical violence didn't start until about after 3.5 years. But what did start is there were some things that started to happen very early on. I would say about a year and a half into the relationship. And there's a pattern. As a matter of fact, there's since we've been running this these groups, and it's I think almost 3 years now that we've been running the domestic abuse groups at the Canadian Center for Men and Families. Since we've been running them, we've noticed that there's this real pattern with men and their experience and their partners. And so we started to kind of catalog some of those experiences and some of the behaviors that their partners, the abusers, have exhibited. And we have now actually developed about 20 behaviors that we know that happen in almost all of these relationships. And I want to also just put a little caveat here when I speak about this, is that this is not empirical evidence. This is just based on our experience. I will talk about some research and some empirical evidence a little bit later on around these issues, but this is just our own experience. And there's what they would call on the research a selection bias, in that the men who are in this program found the program. They're a specific type of man, possibly, so they're not, it's not a general audience, it's a specific one. But there's 20 different characteristics that we've kind of identified of the abusers. And when new men come into the program, we show them these 20 characteristics, and almost everyone will say there's somewhere between 17 or 20 of those characteristics they saw in their partner. So it seems to be a fairly common thing. And one of them is what's called gaslighting. And gaslighting, for those of you that don't know the term, it actually came from a movie that was produced in the 40s. And basically what the ultimate outcome of gaslighting is that when one person, through actions, creates a situation where the other person actually becomes their own reality, and they don't believe what they're seeing with their eyes, or they don't believe what they're thinking, and they question everything, and then therefore the other person, who's the gaslighter, begins to be able to control them, because then the only reality that the person who's being gaslighted has is what the other person tells them, because they can't believe their own reality. So in the movie, the reason where the term gaslighting came from is the a husband, and this is before electricity, in a house was turning the gas lamps down a little, just a touch every day, and his wife was saying, "Is it getting darker in here?" And he's going, "No, no, it's fine." And he turned it down and turned it down, and she got to the point where she couldn't believe her own eyes, her own reality. And the thing that happens with gaslighting is, even though it might only happen in one little place, it actually generalizes to all of our thinking about ourselves, and we start just questioning everything about it. And so that was actually the first thing that started happening in my relationship. And the gaslighting started in a very interesting way. I'm not saying this is true for every relationship, but for me it was this. My ex-partner had actually quite a few rules, or a lot of rules, and one of the kind of rules or protocols how we greeted each other when someone came into a room. So if someone was already in a room and someone came into the room, the rule was the person walking into the room had to do the greeting. Or that someone came home, they were to come home and say, hey, I'm home. And so what started happening over a period of time is we had that agreement that that's what was working. And then she started changing it. She just started going, no, it's the person that's in the room that's supposed to do that. So I'd walk into the room, say hi, and she'd go, why did you interrupt me? It's, you know, you wait, you're supposed to wait until I say something to you because I'm in the middle of doing something. And so the first few times I heard that, I was like, no, that's not so cool. You're an asshole. And then I just got used to going the other way, and then she changed the rule again and went back to the other way. And after about 6 months of that, I started just going, like, I don't even know what the rule is anymore. I'm not even going to try anymore. And so I began, actually, I started not even walking in the room that she was in because I didn't know what the rule was, and I didn't want to get into a harangue about in a conversation about what the rule was. So that's one example of it. There was many of those that happened day in and day out, but that's the gaslighting part. And so after a period of time, there's a few things that happen. One is, I started losing my grip on reality. I kept thinking to myself, no, that's not that one. I don't, what is the rule? And that started happening in many different areas. And then the other part about it is you start disconnecting emotionally from that person because it gets very hard to have an emotional connection when you don't actually know what to do to connect with that person. Another way that she did that with me is challenging my own thinking. So not about this rule about coming into the room, but things like I would say, we would have a conversation actually on a Tuesday, and a Saturday I would reference that conversation, and she said, no, we didn't talk about that. Or no, you didn't say that, or no, I didn't say that. And I'm thinking, yeah, I'm sure you did. I remember it. I've got a decent memory. I can remember that. And over time, with all of those challenges, I just got to a point where I started not believing my own memory, my own mind. I didn't believe what I was thinking. And so then I actually, at that point in time, began to become more dependent on her thinking for me, if that makes any sense, because I'm no longer able to think for myself. I have to have her think for me. And this was a very slow process. It didn't happen overnight. It happened over 2 or 3 years. And it begins a pattern of control. And that's one way that it happens. There are many others. So, and over time, what started happening is she had always had an emotional dysregulation, we'll call it. So she would easily get angry. And then that went from anger actually into rage over time. I mean, it became raging. And it started out when she was raging, she would be yelling at me in the very beginning. And then as time went along, it progressed. And it actually started, I remember the very first time that she threw something at me. It was a rolled up piece of paper, like an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper. And she rolled it up and threw it at me. I was only a few feet away from her, hit me, in the face. Didn't hurt, nothing like that. But that progressed. Then the next time it was actually a little 2x2 post-it pad of post-it notes threw that at me. And then things got bigger. She started throwing pens and pencils and utensils, kitchen utensils, and cups and glasses and plates and things. And it just progressed to eventually at one point in time it was a frying pan that she threw at me. That didn't hit me, but still, the intent was there. And then it progressed to, and I do remember the very first time that she hit me. So I was kind of laying on a sofa on my side. We were having a discussion, and this is another feature of the emotional dysregulation and the rage, is that we would go from what I would consider a very benign, innocuous discussion. 1 second, and then literally within 1 second, she was in a blinding rage. So that happened. We were having the discussion. I didn't think we were having anything. I don't remember the topic, but it didn't seem to be contentious to me. And the next second, she was in a rage. And I was, as I said, lying on the couch, and she with two hands just came down and pounded me on the thigh. Again, no permanent damage, nothing like that, but it really shocked me. And I actually said to her, you hit me, you just hit me. I was flabbergasted, and she left the room, then she came back about 2 minutes later and started calling me a baby. Oh, you big baby, you big crybaby, you know, you can't take getting hit. And what that actually starts to do, again, is that it turns the action. It's called projection. Again, another one of those 20 questions that we have, or 20 behaviors. The projection is taking the things that they did and turning them back on the other person, so or the things that are going on for them. And so that happened, and then maybe a month or two later, well, actually, she hit me a few more times, punched me in the shoulder. One time I was just standing there again. We were having this fairly benign discussion, and I was leaning against the door frame, and she came up to me and grabbed me by the shirt and the chest hair and yanked on it. And I remember taking the shirt off later and having a shirt full of chest hair loose in the bottom of my shirt. And then the most one that I would hold as the most severe is that in the kitchen one day, again, having just a benign discussion, and she had her back to me and she was chopping some vegetables. And there was an island in the kitchen. I was on the other side of the island. And she just turned around again in this blind rage with this knife in her hand and started coming towards me with the knife. And I said to her a couple of times, put the knife down, put the knife down. She didn't. She kept moving towards me. And so, fortunately, the island was between us, and there was a door at the other end of the island to the outside backyard. So I just went out the door to the backyard and wandered around the neighborhood for half an hour, 45 minutes, and then came back, and she had gone to her room. By that time, we were in separate rooms. And she'd gone to her room, and that was kind of the end of it. We never talked about it again. So that was the violence part. The other part was that over time, I was actually just getting, I just had less, fewer and fewer actual resources as a human being. I got to the place where by near the end of the relationship, I almost couldn't look after myself. I hardly ever left the house. I was having some real physical responses. I ended up being diagnosed with depression. I was having panic attacks. I couldn't walk. I have always been a fairly fit person. Can usually, you know, run 10K, walk a long ways. I couldn't walk one block without becoming short of breath and heart rate racing. And so I went and had some tests done to see if I was having heart problems, etc. Turns out I was. Once I got all the results back, the doctor actually said to me, so, but what is going on? And that's when I told the doctor, the first person I'd actually told what was going on. And so at that point in time, my doctor kind of told me, she said, you know, after I told her all the stuff that was going on, and by the way, she was the family doctor, so she was also my partner's doctor. She said to me, you know, you really need to get out of that relationship because it's killing you, and not you know, the physical violence that was being done to me, but the emotional, psychological impact. And I really feel like I was getting close to death, if not physical death, emotional death, psychic death. I couldn't think for myself. And as an illustration of that, I actually decided to leave 2 weeks before I left. One of the things I decided to do based on information that I'd gotten from other people and websites that I'd looked at was to make a list of things to take with me. And so for 2 weeks, I was diligent about making a list of things that I wanted to take with me, you know. And at the end of 2 weeks, I actually had 4 things on the list. That was the level of my mental capability at that time, is I just couldn't think. I couldn't remember things. I couldn't focus on anything for more than about 2 seconds. And so that's where I was. I was very fortunate that I ended up getting out of there. A family member came and got me, and I left. I just left all my stuff there. It's still there, and it's 2.5 years ago, and haven't had any contact since because it just there's no. I haven't had the emotional resources to do it, and B. It was a manipulative. I felt it was a manipulative environment, and I just don't want to put myself back in that place again. So I'm just moving on with my life and left everything there.
Wow, that's incredible. And here you are today,
yeah,
talking about it. So that's even more spectacular. You know, and being a man really, really makes even harder because all these rules we're put into place as young men growing up.
Really, really makes
Carter.
Yes.
And so now you're apart, and you're kind of trying to find your own way again. So what kind of brought you into what you're doing at the center?
Right, yeah. So, I need to go back to a little bit of my story as well to talk about that. Because once I made the decision that I needed to leave, or after my doctor told me I needed to leave, I actually decided that I was going to call some agencies for help. And so I, you know, Googled and looked for agencies in the area, the Greater Toronto Area. And there was about eight of them, and they were all the shelters or hotlines for domestic violence victims. You know? And so I called them, and I got a range of responses. Honestly, there was a range. And I got the responses that I got fell into this range. At one end, at the most helpful end, were people who empathized with my situation, but couldn't give me any practical help whatsoever. Because there was just no services for men, or they didn't know what the services for men were in that situation. There was no shelters, there was no nothing. So that's at one end of the spectrum. Of the eight, there was probably two or three that the person on the other end of the phone was really empathetic, but just couldn't help me in any practical way. Then there was about two or three in the middle there somewhere who were not empathetic, but not really aggressive either. They were just like, very matter of fact, no, we can't help you, and got me off the phone fairly quickly. And then there was probably two, I guess, at the other end of the spectrum that were actually quite hostile towards me. And the one, actually, this is the person answering the phone at the hotline or the shelter, I'm not sure which one it was, who suggested to me that I was actually the person, the perpetrator, and that I needed to get myself some help. And she referred me to an anger management program. So that I could get anger management, because she quickly diagnosed that was my problem.
So judgment before really knowing the story.
Exactly. I literally just called up for help,
and you were judged.
I was referred to an anger management program.
Wow.
Yeah,
but you know what? In some ways, it doesn't surprise me, because the level of empathy for some of these agencies that are out there is pretty minimal, and some of them, without naming anybody, are very judgmental without really knowing the facts.
Yeah.
And and one of the biggest things, like you do now, and myself, is one of the biggest things that we do is we listen to what other people have to say.
Yes.
We're not there to judge people what's the good truth. So now back to the center. So this brought you.
Yeah. So what happened is that I was very fortunate. So I moved with my sister, which happened to be to Newmarket. That's where she lived. And I was able to stay with my sister for a while and kind of get back on my feet. And I was introduced to an agency in New York region that is there. They describe themselves as a hub for people who have violence and abuse. And they are open to male and female. I will say, I think probably 95% of their clients are female. I mean, I went there often, and I got counseling there as well as other supports, and I was the only man that I ever saw there. So, but really kudos to them for providing that support. But the other thing they did for me is they did some research on supports for men in the Greater Toronto Area, and they were actually the ones that located this agency, the Canadian Centre for Men and Families. So I mean, there, and it turns out that they had this program that was running for men who have experienced domestic violence. And so I enrolled in the program. I went and did the program. At that time, it was run by a psychologist, a counselor, a trauma counselor. And she had designed the program. And she's actually someone who has worked with the Gatehouse as well in the past, Lynn McDonnell.
Yes, I've worked with her closely as well.
Yeah, so Lynn designed that program at the Canadian Centre for Men and Families. And then after three or four cycles of it, it was a collective decision to convert it into a peer-led instead of a therapy-led type group. And so I had been going through a number of cycles, three or four cycles, and I just stepped up and I did some training with the Gatehouse. I'm a peer facilitator. And so now me and another person are now being the peer facilitators. And the program is very, it's what's classified as psychoeducational. I mean, there's education part about our psychology. But I think it's probably 7% support, with it's just men. have similar stories, who can go there and talk to each other. And one of the challenges with some of these statistics that we hear about and the kind of the socialization and society's belief about domestic violence is that men who are in this situation often believe they're the only one. They don't believe that it's happening to anybody else. And so when they get into a room with other men who have very similar stories, and I talked about those 20 sort of behavior characteristics,
yeah.
If they hear that, they go, oh my God, like what? Other people having exactly, and you can hear somebody in the room telling their story, and the other men just going, like you can hear the pennies drop. It's like, oh yeah, that's exactly what happened to me. And often someone will say, yeah, we were all married to the same person, you know, because the patterns are so very similar. And yet, men feel so alone because before they can find something like this, they just feel like no one else could understand them. And in fact, there's quite a bit of evidence that for men that they are alone, actually. I talked about that statistic. So when I got to the center and started seeing what was going on and realizing how many men, because I, like everybody else, thought I was the only one, and I started seeing some of the different statistics and realizing how many men out there and how they were out there who were suffering and how few services there were for those men, I started getting more and more involved. And in leading these programs, I continue, it looks like people that are there that are leading are putting out energy and giving, but in fact, I'm getting as much as I'm giving, because every time I go through one of these cycles with a group, I learn and I grow and I heal, and so it's really good for me as well. So that's how I got involved. But let me talk a little bit about why men maybe think they're the only one. Yeah, so I want to talk a little bit about the statistics about domestic abuse and 85%, which is out there, and it actually is a true number, but here's another true number. The other true number is this, that there's a StatsCan survey that was done in 2014 on family violence. And what it found is that 4% of the Canadian population reported anonymously, because StatsCan is anonymous, reported anonymously 4% that they had been victims of domestic abuse. And that was split almost completely equally between men and women. So it turns out 342,000 women, 418,000 men reported, or males, and females and males reported that they had experienced domestic abuse.
Wow.
So that number suggests that it's closer to 50-50. So how is the 85 and where's the 50-50? And 85 is violence that has been reported to the police. So 85% of the violence that happens in Canada of the violence that happens, 85% of it is reported that men are the abusers. Whereas when people are asked anonymously, really 50%, it's equal. Men are abused as equally in the same amount as women are. And there's lots of research on that, aside from the StatsCan thing. And I don't want to get too far into, you know, is that number exactly right or what numbers are right. But I want to use an illustration to show you how that 85% could be looked at in a different light. And this is from a gentleman who was in the program, and I have his permission to share this, so I'm sure his name or any of those things, any details. He's a very mild-mannered, probably even more mild-mannered than Clark Kent, you know. Mild-mannered, very slight man. And his story is he had been abused physically and emotionally, et cetera, by both his wife and his university-aged daughter. She was in university, but living at home. And both his wife and his daughter abused him. Both physically and emotionally. But in this particular day, he was out in the backyard, he was fixing a fence in the backyard, it was getting later in the day, and it was in the fall, and it was starting to get dark, and he wanted to get the fence finished before dark, and his wife called him and said, you know, dinner's ready, and he said, you know, I just want to get this fence finished, and then I'll come in. And there wasn't any upset at that time. And so he came in, and he thought it was maybe about a half an hour later, and dinner had already been done, they cleaned it up, and his wife said, you're not getting any dinner because you didn't come in when I called you. So that's it. He was fine with that. There was, again, no contention, no argument at that time. So then he started making his own dinner. And she got very angry at him. And he had a pot of boiling water on the stove, and she knocked that pot of boiling water off. Some of it splashed on this gentleman, and he had some mild burning. But then an argument ensued, and his wife and daughter actually put him on the floor, held him down, kicked and beat him to the degree that he had bruises all over his upper body and on his legs. They did that for 2 hours. Kept him captive in the kitchen. He was eventually able to escape and get away, and he went to the neighbors, got the neighbors to call the police, which they did. The police law arrived, and they interviewed him. One officer stayed with him. The other officer went and interviewed his wife and daughter. That officer came back, and they arrested him and took him to jail. And so that one, aside from the, aside from the fact that that's unfair, the unfairness of it, the other part is, that's going to show up in the statistics as the men being the aggressor in that situation.
That's your question. Very, very. Now, do you think there's a lot of bias still in regards to law enforcement in regards to this? That automatically they assume that it's the man, right?
Yes. I think they do. I think it's changing, definitely, because the stories that I heard 3 years ago were more that there was a bias, and I'm hearing more stories that there aren't as much bias now. Another story I'll just tell you quickly that happened, and this one happened about 5 or 6 years ago. I know the gentleman that it happened to, and I wasn't around when it actually happened, but he tells this story, is he and his wife had a disagreement in the kitchen. There was no physical, he didn't hit her and she didn't hit him until she grabbed a knife off the counter and stabbed him in the abdomen, and he was bleeding, and the cops came and arrested him. So what I do think is changing. When I directly talk to police officers, you know, they say their policy is to investigate and they're really good at doing this, and yet I still think there is a bias towards charging the man or taking the man out of the home. And that's another reason why men underreport is, and you just have to work this scenario through, but just think about it. You're a man. Part of our socialization is that part of our job is to protect our family. And you've got young kids in the home, and you're with someone who's abusive. And so what do you do? How do you mitigate that situation? If you call the police, you're likely to be taken out of the home. And if you're taken out of the home, then what you're literally doing is abandoning, not by your own choice, but you're abandoning your children with someone who you know to be violent.
Yeah, it's still very, very one-sided. And that has a long way to go as far as I'm concerned, because even in society, I'm just talking, not just our conversation here, but what I've heard, just back, that hasn't changed a whole lot.
No, and that's that goes beyond that conversation. That goes beyond the police. It goes into family court and how the family courts deal with it. And I think it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 80-90% of the time when a situation ends up in the courts that the women get most of the custody, and men get visitation rights or occasional. And so that's still the case. And so again, if you're a man and you are in a situation that you don't think is healthy, that makes it hard to choose that option, knowing that you're going to lose connection with your kids. How do you choose that option?
Yeah, that really makes it really difficult. I know a lot of single fathers out there now, for example, and where we are now the provider of family. The ex-wife is not there anymore,
right?
No, and we're providing. Now, for example, in my situation, my ex-wife, when I was married, when she took off, we were split up already, but I have a child. So you abandon the child comes to me. So
yeah.
How does the courts deal with something like that? And then she's off being a drug addict, she's off and on her own thing. So, I know even prior to that, when we were together, there was abuse, not to the extent that you're talking about. I actually didn't lose kind of both sides, but my point I'm trying to make, or what I'm trying to get at, is that a lot of fathers now are becoming are the parents.
Yes.
And the mother's not in the picture. Well, in my situation, I guess my point I was trying to make was that my ex-wife was not in the picture.
Yeah.
She abandoned my daughter, and then the daughter came with me. And thing was, though, my point, Dan, adding on this, is that when I even in the court system, automatically assume, like what you're saying, and I've seen this a thousand times too, that automatically just because we're a man, we're assumed that, well, we're obviously we're supposed to be the breadwinner, but we're all being powerful, and we should be able to take all that kind of abuse, why would it come our way from this side?
Right, exactly, yes.
So why would it happen?
Yeah.
If you're a man, so your wife's half your size, how could she do that?
Well, she has. Yeah.
So explain that.
Yeah. Well, you bring up a great point, because for those of you that can see me on Periscope, I'm, 6'2", and I'm 240 pounds, 50 pounds, a big guy, and my partner's about 130 pounds, so almost exactly half my size. And the question often becomes, well, like, you know, like, how do you let that happen? And I know that, you know, the joke is size matters, but in fact, here, size does not matter. What actually matters is temperament and willingness to be violent. And the truth about this also for me is that, again, this is not empirical evidence. I'm just going by the men who come into the program that we run, is that, you know, almost all of those men, I'll be honest, some of the men who are in the program have participated in violence themselves, in domestic, and so some have, but the vast majority of them have not. Or, I'll give you another situation, is that there's one gentleman who's been in the program, who was married to a woman for 20-some years, it was 23 or something, and the abuse in their relationship started about 5 years in, the physical abuse, she abused him, it happened often, there was often physical abuse, pulling his hair, scratching his face, there was all kinds of, kind of a litany of things that happened. And then one day, 23 years into their relationship, before work one morning, he was having his breakfast, reading the paper, and she was haranguing him, and etc. And he took the paper and swiped at her and hit her on the shoulder with the paper, and not a whole newspaper, just a section of it, you know. And he went to work, and the police arrived at work and took him out of the boardroom that he was in handcuffs.
Wow.
And it was because he hit her. And she hit the, you know, and I'm not saying all of the situations are like this. I'm just saying that most of the men who have come through our program are men who would not be aggressive towards others, and particularly women. And so, and I find myself in that category. I would never hit a woman, or a man even, you know.
You're not an aggressive.
I'm just not an aggressive person, you know. And this is part of the psychology, my psychological makeup that allowed me to stay, to that question of why did you stay, is I actually took pride in the fact that I could take it. You know, so I could take that. That was a source of pride for me, which obviously didn't serve me out. But that's part of what my psychological makeup was. So, and that's true of most of the men in the program, is that they just take it, they withstand it, they absorb it. And so I actually, at some point in time, heard myself talking to myself with my ex-partner when she was very angry, and I was saying to myself, I can help her. And so I was trying to absorb her anger to help her, when in fact I wasn't really looking after myself.
And do you think, and this is obviously going to be, it's going to fall back to what we were brought up to believe, that also being a man, well, we should have taken that.
Exactly.
Right? But it falls back on that
yeah.
Same thing. We should have taken.
Oh, yeah. I mean, my upbringing was, boys don't cry.
Yeah.
Be strong. Be strong. Yeah, yeah. Walk it off. Yeah. That was
yeah.
The way I was.
Yeah.
I metabolized that, really well.
Yeah, I mean, when I come to think about it, I think of some relationships where, yes, I got really angry, but I would never do that. I could never do that. It's like being my child. I never had my child.
Right.
So why would I get a woman?
Yeah.
You know, it makes some sense. And they get angry. I certainly would teach.
Yeah, and I think I think anger is it's a natural human emotion. Some people argue how healthy it is. I don't know about that, but the actual act of getting angry is not the problem. It's how you act when you're angry, you know. And so if getting angry at someone is I think socially acceptable, situation is socially acceptable, but how you react and how you respond to that other person, that, you know.
So in the groups that you have going there now, are you getting gay men coming in and having the same issue as well?
Yes. Yeah.
I think it's important for listeners to know this as well.
Yeah.
It's just not. It's not just that. It's not gender based.
That's right.
Meaning that it's not a traditional relationship. It could be in a gay relationship, for what I'm trying to say as well.
Yes. So let me throw some more statistics out at you.
Okay.
And these ones, and I'll just for your audience, I will just I'll give you, if you want more information, if you're really interested in just really diving into the numbers, there's a great database. It's in the U.S. A lot of the research that's on the database is in the U.S., but they have stuff from Canada, Australia, and the United States, or the U.K. as well. And it's all about family violence, domestic abuse, and it's called PASC. The project is called PASC. It's P-A-S-K, and it's the Partner Assault State of Knowledge. That's what PASK. Partner Assault State of Knowledge. And basically, it's a clearinghouse deal or repository for all. They just collected all of the research from various English-speaking countries in the world. And it's all in there. And you can go search it, and you can find out all kinds of information you want. And so some of the information is this. And this is also very contentious, can be contentious when it's compared to what the sort of public narrative about it is. I know that there's a lot of talk about it being gender-based violence.
Yeah.
I use that word, gender-based violence. And if you really look at the numbers, yes, in most cases, because most relationships are heterosexual, it is a gender thing. But the truth is that it happens in any relationship. And the actual numbers, and I don't have these statistics on me right now, but the prevalence of domestic violence is actually higher in lesbian relationships than it is in any of the others. So that's the highest incident of domestic violence.
Well, I wonder why.
Yeah, I don't know why either, but it is. It could be because there's societal pressure on that relationship as well.
Yeah.
You know, external pressure of who they have to be. And then to kind of maybe further that point is the next type of relationship, the next highest prevalence is in gay relationships and then heterosexual relationships. So there is something about that there actually is potentially more in some of those.
And I would tend to agree. I would think it would be society as a whole pressuring the non-traditional relationship as being, well, they're the one being picked on.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so as I said, if you want to look up that data, go to PASC. It's there. The other piece of information that I found very interesting when I first started doing some research on this, and it really challenged some of my assumptions about it, is that some of the research looks at the type of violence, and one of they divide it into two different type of categories, and one is what they call bilateral violence. In other words, violence where both parties are participating in it.
Okay.
And that's not the bilateral is most of when they look at the bilateral, it's something that happens over a period of time. It's not one event that happens. It's something that happens over a period of time. So if you and I were in a relationship, that bilateral thing means that maybe this Saturday night you start an argument that gets, you know, escalates, and next Saturday night I start. And so if you look at over the length of that relationship, it's about equal who starts the arguments and the abuse and so on. And in those relationships, so they call that bilateral. And in terms of when they look at the totality of all the relationships that have domestic abuse in them, about 50% of the domestic abuse relationships fall into that bilateral category.
Wow.
Where both partners have some responsibility for it. Then the other category is what they call unilateral. In other words, one partner is precipitating the violence primarily. Occasionally, the other partner might do something, usually not physical, but might yell or something as a self-defense mechanism.
Yeah.
But it's primarily a unilateral type situation. So the flow of violence and abuse is going in one direction. In those, when it's unilateral, 35% of the time it's the female that is the aggressor, and 15% of the time it's the male. of that additional 50%.
Wow.
So in fact, if you look at, again, sort of that classic way that it's described in society, where they say, you know, 85% of violence is against women, when in fact, actually, it's in terms of aggressors, unilateral aggressors, only 15% of the time is men.
Wow, that's pretty broad range number.
Exactly, according to that research.
Yeah.
And again, I don't want everything we talk about here to hang on the research. You know, the reality is what I'm most interested in is people, both men and women, who are not realizing that they're in a relationship and not realizing the harm that's being done to them and going and getting some help. And when I talk about that, I also want to talk about this, is that there's some research out there that shows that people, children who grew up in a relationship where there was a domestic abuse have a 30% higher chance of also then getting into a relationship with domestic abuse. On one side or the other of the equation, but a 30% chance higher. So actually what we're doing is we're kind of just grooming them, to use a word.
Yeah.
You know, we're grooming them to create more violence.
Wow.
And there's another piece of research that was done by an insurance company looking at what they called an adverse childhood events or effects or something. And one of the things they looked at was growing up in a family with domestic abuse. And those children, when they grow up to adults, have much worse health outcomes. So they're more likely to have heart attack, cancer, high blood pressure, diabetes, lung issues, you know, COPD, and asthma, and so on.
Wow.
So
health-related issues.
Yeah, and so for what I see, those health-related issues, not just the effect of the people who are actually engaging in the activities or one who may be absorbing the activities, but also the children observing it, it becomes even more important for me to say, you know, let's see how we can interrupt this cycle of violence. First part is education, having people understand what it is, you know, that it's actually happening to them. And then the second part is, you know, having some kind of interventions, which is what the Canadian Center for Men and Families is doing. You know.
So let's go back and let's jump and dive into this a little bit.
Sure.
No, let's dive into the program a little bit in regards to, now it's a 12-week program you mentioned, right?
Yeah, it's 12 weeks.
So what are the stuff you cover? Let's say, so what would you do in the first week, for example? Now I know it's peer facilitated as well, and as you said as well, right?
Right. Yeah, so it's peer facilitated, and it's also, we do have a curriculum.
Okay,
well,
yeah.
That we work through. And the other thing I would say is also to note that it's what we call a closed group. So it's not drop-in.
Yeah.
You know, the people that start and the people that go all the way through, and then anybody who wants to come in goes into the next cycle. And there's an aspect of it that is, even though we have a curriculum and a framework, which is actually my preference word for it, a framework of things we want to cover,
a structure.
It is organic. And so there can be, it's support. And we really kind of hold that it's about 70% support, 30% educational. So the support can look like sometimes one of the men comes to a group, and our groups are on Wednesday night. We'll come on a Wednesday night, and on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, they had court, and something really dramatic happened, and they need support, and they need to talk it through. And we end up spending a fair amount of time just on that issue. And usually what happens is that issue starts coming up for that person. Other people kind of relate to it and resonate with it, and then we start bringing stuff up for them. And so even though we have a curriculum and a framework, it's very organic too. So some of the things that we deal with, some of the curriculum sort of things, and the way we would often, if someone doesn't have anything, any burning thing that they need to share or support around, we will kind of introduce something and then have that, use that as a way to talk about our own personal experiences when we either did that or didn't do that. So one example would be personal boundaries. You know, that's, you know, for most of the men, again, in this group, the issue often is that we didn't set boundaries for ourselves in order to protect ourselves. And there's a saying that we have, and that is the lack of boundaries invites lack of respect. And, you know, I talked about those 20 things that are common behavior traits. Well, one of the common behavior traits that we find of the partners that we've been with is that they actually test boundaries. And if you go back, you know, almost every man that we've had in the group, we go back and talk about, you know, how did they test your boundaries? And usually the way it progressed was this, so that the partner, the abusive or the aggressive partner, would push, push, and push, and push until they got to where they found that the boundary was. And then they would stop, but they would come back to that boundary again in a month or 2 months or 3 months, and they would just keep slowly eroding that boundary and working it back and working it back. And for the men who were in the program, and myself included, I had to stand up for that boundary. You know, when you, if I talk to some other man and I tell them my experience, they go, well, I would have left. Why didn't you leave? Well, part of it was because I didn't have, you know, strong enough boundaries, or I wasn't aware of my boundaries, or part of it is just that I'm an empathetic type person, and I wanted to be able to support my partner, so I didn't want to. And I'm also conflict averse, you know? I don't like to have conflict, so I tried to placate. So we'll talk about that. The other thing we talk about is, we talk quite a bit about emotion. And I know, you know, I was recommended to go to anger management. The actual challenge with many of the men in our groups is not so much anger, but it's actually recognizing that they're having emotions and being able to deal with them. Emotions like fear and not feeling appreciated. I don't know if it's not exactly emotion, but those kind of thoughts that they're having. And worthiness and things like that, those are the emotions that the men that goes through this program haven't done a good job of identifying. So we talk a lot about identifying our emotions. How are we feeling? And feeling can actually help us with barriers, you know, because if we're feeling disrespected and we recognize that we're feeling disrespected, then we can use that as a barrier. But if we just acknowledge that feeling or don't believe in that feeling or dismiss it, then we don't have it, we don't get boundaries, you know.
Yeah. No, do you hear, do you talk about it? How does guilt come into play? Is guilt pretty heavy in there?
Yeah, guilt and shame, and it's actually, guilt and shame are actually almost level two of this, you know. They're not how people show up originally. There's actually sort of they call it a triphasic, three-part kind of steps to recovery, if you will, from all trauma. And people who have been in domestic abuse have been traumatized. And the first one is just stability and safety, you know, becoming stable and feeling safe and becoming stable. And then the second one is being able to see the reality of the situation and speak to the reality and have a little bit of grief and mourning about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next stage is more the reintegration into your life and rebuilding your life and so on. And it seems that people have to go through those stages. So often the men that arrive in our groups do need a little bit of stability. Their lives are, you know, a mess and they need to stabilize some things. And then the next step is to actually start recognizing what happened. And to me, I did this, and it's extraordinary that I see it happening with other men. Even though I did it, I still see it as extraordinary because you can see in other people what they can't see in themselves. But one of the things that we do, the men who've been through this that I have experience with, is we diminish the activities of the abuser. You know, we say, well, it wasn't that bad, or she didn't mean it, or he didn't mean it, or it was, or I caused it, you know. She got angry, but I must have done something that caused her to be angry, and so I should figure that out, right? So instead of, again, no boundary there, instead of saying, my boundary is that's inappropriate behavior, the way that you're treating me when you're angry, I went the other way, and I went, oh, what am I doing wrong? What did I do to cause this? So that's, people sort of have to get beyond that to get that reality, that, yeah, that wasn't appropriate, what that person was doing to me. And then the guilt and shame start to sink in, or they become in touch with it, I would say. Yeah.
So what would you say would be the biggest factor that men feel after this experience in regards to, like, for emotion?
You mean after their experience of being in an abusive
relationship?
Yeah.
Well, which would you say is the biggest emotion you figure that men deal with in this? Or there's no commonalities.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know if there's one big one. There's sort of a range of emotions that men go through. And so there's the, you know, I would almost call it diminishment of the activities, and then sort of then the guilt and the shame. And then there's a, I think often sort of a, men beat themselves up for staying, and maybe even for leaving because their kids are still there. Men who have left kids and don't have as much contact with kids have a huge amount of frustration, and they just have a lot of feelings about that. That's very, very hard on men I'll take my situation. My kids had already left, but I know that, you know, my kids were my life every single day. It killed me if they weren't all of a sudden, you know? So for men who have younger children who are still in the home, that's the hardest thing for them to get over, is their feelings of loss and grief and shame at themselves and anger and guilt, and, you know, there's a whole host of emotions. It's actually easier for men who are a little bit older and don't have that. So men go through a range of emotions, and I wouldn't say one is bigger than the other per se. They all come, and they all, you know, hopefully part of our program is giving men an opportunity to work through it. And even though it's a 12-week program, many men, it's not uncommon for men to come through two and sometimes three cycles, as they just grow and learn and feel more comfortable and being able to share their story. And there's men that are not even comfortable sharing their story through one whole cycle. They don't really talk about the real depths of their story, or they throw a few things that happened, but not how they felt about how it happened, or, you know, the depth of their emotion. And then the second or maybe third cycle that starts happening. And it's when we can get in touch with that, how we really felt about what happened, truly felt about what happened, beyond the anger and the shame and so on, that's where I see the healing starts.
Well, you know, and I have to ask you about the anger part. How is the anger? I'm just trying to understand that. How does it fall in place with this? I mean, I can understand where a person would be angry that first off this happens, and I can see the attachments. Like, okay, well, I'm a man, so this shouldn't be happening to me if that even comes up.
Right.
I'm not saying it does, but does that even come up? Well, I'm a man, this shouldn't happen. Total disbelief. I know you kind of touched on disbelief or minimizing
right.
a little bit.
Yeah.
But what about the anger? Like, I mean, how is that, again, that's another one I'm trying to wrap my head around.
Yeah. Well, the anger seems to come after the realization that it actually happened. You know, once they drew reality, and just to kind of give this some context, sometimes men will come into the program in the first two or three weeks, they will talk about some of the incidents that happened, and they will always preface it with, you know, she's a really good person, and they will actually give us a whole history of all the great things about her before they'll talk about that. And then once they start allowing themselves to see some of the things that really happened, you know, there's men who have had horrendous things done to them, and they just didn't even see it as a horrendous thing. You know, they just almost diminished it and dismissed it and so on. So once they can start to see that, oh, that was a horrendous thing, then they start getting angry, and the anger is actually directed in two directions, at the abuser, but they're also becoming angry themselves for having allowed themselves to be in that situation.
Yeah, and I guess that's kind of what I'm asking is whether it's them themselves, or is it, you know, what they got out of, or
right.
is it somebody else, or
it goes both ways. Even in one conversation, you can see it actually going both ways. They're angry at what was done to them, but they were also angry at themselves for allowing it to be done. And that's actually just a progression. So then at some point in time, after experiencing that anger for, you know, a period of time, maybe 2 or 3 weeks or a whole cycle, 12 weeks, then they move on to the next one, you know, kind of the acceptance. And, oh, okay, that happened. It's not judging. I'm not judging me. I'm not judging the other person. It just happened. Now, what do I do with that? How do I move on with my life? You know. And that also brings me up to another point that I wanted to make, and I feel a little embarrassed that I didn't make it earlier. When we talk about abusers, a lot of the research shows that they were abused themselves at some point in time. So I don't want to demonize them either. They have, their actions are adaptations that they have developed to survive what happened to them. And so they're just doing the best they can. You know, we're all just doing the best we can with the tools that we have available and with the, you know, with their experience and our background. So, as I said, I don't want to demonize them, but I do want people to understand what happened in these relationships. So, so I'm telling these, I'm using these illustrations of things that happened, but I fully understand that the people that are the aggressors have backgrounds as well that are probably not very happy ones. No.
So you just have the 1-12-8 program. So when you do that, you just, if you want to do it again, you go back to the same one, or
yes,
or you go to another level. Like, for example, now we have a couple levels here today. That's like whether you like the men's program, for example. Sorry, I don't mean to stray off.
No,
yeah, just a great example. But our men's program, like, you do 15 weeks, and then you can either go back and do the program again, or you can go up,
right,
and talk more about mindfulness, and hopefully forgiveness has come in there to some play. And I'm not talking towards your abuser, I'm talking towards yourselves, is what I'm getting at.
Right.
And well, if it's towards your abuser, that's all right too, but more concerned about yourself. That mindfulness, about gratitude, and trying to let things go, and not holding on to things. Or in other words, not being stuck anymore,
right,
and going forward, is what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
That's the idea with our phase two program. So you just have the one program?
Yeah, we're not to phase two yet. We need a few more men who have kind of graduated.
Yeah.
I don't know how we're to the gate at this, but I suspect that the number of people that do phase one, not all of them go on to phase two.
No, and it's correct. So it's, I mean,
right,
obviously there's been differences.
Right.
And it's not even the same thing. I totally get that. But just as a self-comparison to, you know,
yeah,
how will we peer support,
right,
in regards, right?
Yeah, and I, for me, a long-term vision is to have a, what I would call, you know, a 2.0, right?
2.0,
yeah. Is to have that, and it be more in line with what Gatehouse is doing, more on working on our own inner, you know.
Our core.
Yeah, because that first, that 1.0 is really sort of getting to a place, you know, recognizing the trauma, getting stabilized, recognizing the trauma, seeing it as real, and then just seeing it as is, not something that, you know, it was traumatic, but just as an event, and then reintegrating our lives. Once people get to reintegrate and kind of get back into our lives with feet back under them, then I think they become ready for 2.0. And we just don't have enough men through 1.0 yet to do that, but that would be a long term.
So how long has this program been in existence now then?
It would be almost 3 years.
Almost 3 years.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, you mentioned that.
Yeah,
almost 3 years.
Almost three.
So how many programs have you figured you've gone through?
Cycles?
Yeah, cycles.
We're on our seventh cycle.
Cycle.
Yeah, yeah. We just finished our sixth, actually last night. We finished our sixth. So, and so I want to tell the audience that on the 25th, the Wednesday the 25th is when the next cycle starts. They're still opening. So if anybody is listening here or knows somebody that, you know, feels like that would be useful for them, they've been in a situation or are currently in a situation. And it's open to anybody who's male identified, just to begin with, and also any kind of domestic abuse. So there are men who've gone through the program who their domestic abuse was with a parent or a sibling that was actually had more impact on them than the one they had with an intimate partner. But it still had a huge impact on them. So if you're living with somebody and you have an emotional connection with them, and there's violence, it has huge impacts. It's hugely traumatic, you know. So so call the center or go on the website. The website is menandfamilies, all one word, .org, menandfamilies.org. And let me get the phone number here, so I'll just put that out there while I'm doing this. The phone number is 647-479-9611.
And that's, of course, the Integrated Trauma Area, the Golden Horseshoe.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, but no matter where you are in Canada, if you call that number and you're in some other area of Canada, they can refer you for other services. The only place that they program, the group is running right now, is in Toronto. But there are men's centers and branches across the country that can help with other things. The other, and it's all free, there's no charge. The other thing that is available that the center offers is one-on-one counseling, and centers in other parts of the Canada offer that one-on-one counseling as well for people who have experienced trauma and abuse. And the other thing I wanted to mention while you're talking about, you know, the Gatehouse and the co-ed, my long-term vision for this is that we have a 1.0 program, that's certainly a 2.0 program that is co-ed, because I think that this is not a gender issue.
No.
And so having both genders in the same room talking about it, I think just kind of normalizes it. It's not about, you know, a woman abused me. It's a person abused me, you know? And I may be naive, but my goal would be to eventually have men and women in the same room.
And that's kind of what we try to do with the Gay Cups as well. Because our experiences, thinking about it, are obviously they're different, but the concept is the same, meaning that, yes, I was a child, I was abused either by a man or a woman, in my case, both, or vice versa.
Right.
So when we do the phase two program, we bring them together. And this is where I found very, very, very valuable, and I think what you're talking about would be just as valuable, because hearing the experiences from both sides helps us understand what we're thinking or our
right.
emotions,
yeah.
and will actually help us, well, to basically understand better.
Yeah.
Each side. So,
yeah, exactly. Absolutely. And I think it'd be very valuable for men who, and I think maybe primarily men who have had a woman who was the abuser, to hear women who get abused as well. Because I know that we can get in our minds that women, you know, we think, oh yeah, women, that's a woman that's abusive. But it's not, it's a person, you know? And I think it'd be very valuable for women to hear men who are abused as well and go, oh yeah, you know, I see. And I don't know, but I think the experiences will be very similar. Not the physical experiences, but the emotional, the way that we experience it might have some similarities.
Now being only men, and I can probably relate to this in a lot of ways because I did an interview as well in this co-ed groups, but how do you find facilitating a group of men that have never talked about this before? Do you find in most cases it's easy, they want to talk, or do you find you have to do a little bit of coercing or share your experience, or what do you do to get the conversation going? I imagine it would be really tough the first night, but and provided they stay with it, probably it's easier as it goes on, but I talked about the first two nights or three nights, it can't be easy.
Well, you'd think. And yet, that's not our experience. So we really talk about actually creating a space of safety, and we talk about that a lot on the first night, that this is just, and it's not being created by any one person, it's created by the group. So it's a space of safety created by the group. We talk about some ground rules and how we're going to work with each other to create that space and how we're going to interact with each other. And then we do start, we actually give people, we put them on a timer and just say you've got 4 minutes or 5 minutes, depending on the size of the group, 4 or 5 minutes to just talk about your experience that brought you here. And we usually have people who are returning into the groups, and often they will speak first because they have the greatest bubble of comfort. They've talked about their story before, and so they tell their story. And really, I'm really amazed and grateful, and that when it gets around to the men who are there for the first time, they share some really things that would be, I suspect, very hard for them to share. And I think it just comes from one, knowing that they're not alone, just to begin with, and that they're actually, I believe, and then again, maybe it's just the men that come to this program, not all men who have been in that situation, but they're really eager to have someone hear them. They really want to be heard because they haven't been heard. And once they find out other people, this happened to other people, they're not alone, they're not the only one, and that there's a space here where I can be heard, it comes out. So it doesn't really, some men does take a little bit longer, but it's also really interesting how quickly it comes out for some men.
So the ones that do find it difficult, could you maybe share what are some of the things that men may find difficult to talk about? I mean, I can guess, but
yeah.
Just others might hear it.
Well, I think just actually talking about the details of actually what they experienced. So the fact that someone hit them, or the fact that someone, and I would say, even though I gotta draw that back, that's not the hardest part. They actually will talk about being hit much more readily than they will talk about being manipulated and emotionally manipulated. That is what comes later. But part of that is not even their reluctance to talk about it. Part of that is them even recognizing that it was happening. Because that's part of it is to understand that men don't, or at least the men that come into our program, don't really recognize it. They diminish it, etc. And so the physical things that happen, because those are like obvious, you can see them.
Yeah.
They can talk about those because they actually happen. They still might minimize them, and they still might make excuses for the person, the abuser, but they can at least talk about them. When they talk about the impact on themselves and how it felt and the emotion, that's where it takes longer. And where that just comes out over time, we don't actually have any kind of strategies to bring it out for men. It really just comes out organically as part of the process. You know, we talk about boundaries. And when we start talking about boundaries, or we start talking about feelings and how did you feel, and we talk about all the range of the different feelings. When did you feel sad, or did you feel, you know, less than, or whatever? And we just ask, did that ever happen to you in your relationship? And then the conversation just goes from there. You know?
Wow, that's incredible. That's really incredible. Where do you see now being? Social media being the way it is, and we hear guys like Donald Trump just round it off and people making accusations. We've had the Gomeshi travel by.
Yeah.
We've had all kinds of things. Hollywood really feeding into this quite a bit. I agree with it and I don't agree with it. The part that I don't agree with is that while Hollywood is great that they're bringing it up and they're talking about it and it's helped society talk about it a little bit more, but at the same time, there's people who've been doing this for a long, long time.
Right.
And they're not being noticed. Not that I'm suggesting that they should be noticed, but what should be noticed is the fact that these services have been there for a long time and they should be recognized, versus just because one person comes out and says, yeah, this has happened to me, and meanwhile, these people have been helping these people for years.
Right.
So, you know, it'd be great if Hollywood, for example, would talk about this and then put something in a community or something where you have these organizations. Just what I'm talking about,
right.
Do that sort of thing. So where do you see this kind of thing going? Or do you think it's just going to spiral kind of crazy like it is? Or do you think that it's going to slow down and maybe society will look at it and say, okay, well, this is a real problem, and actually deal with it in a human way?
Right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, my hope is, I don't know if I'm very good at prognosticating about what's going to happen. I really don't know. But my hope is that the people that are being abused in whatever way it is, you know, whether it's that type, you know, the stuff that's going on in Hollywood, that those are a lot of big power differentials and so on. And in workplaces generally, those types of things, I think any time we can shine a light on what's happening, I think that's a good thing. I think it's been in the dark for a long time. And in fact, it actually hasn't even been in the dark. It's been known about, but it's just never been really acknowledged, you know, and confronted. So anytime that we can shine a light, acknowledge, and confront these things, I think that's a good thing. And then, that's only phase one, right? And then it actually providing services for the people that were injured by it and impacted by it. And those impacts would be really dramatic, I know from my own experience. For things that, I mean, even if I hadn't have been hit, I would have had dramatic impacts.
Psychological?
Yeah. The hitting was actually almost the least of it, although that did really shift something for me. You know, when you're in a relationship with someone and they feel validated that they can hit you, that did shift my mind. It was a huge thing. But to go back to your point, I think the shining the light, providing services for people who've been injured or impacted by it. And then the other thing is that ultimately, hopefully, societal attitudes will change to a place where that's not acceptable. And that it's, you know, if it's seen, it's nipped in the bud right away. The society will, these somebody doing that and step up and say, no, that's wrong. You know?
And I guess there's a second part of this question is, now, where do men fit in here now? Where do we fit in?
Yeah.
Okay, the world is changing right in front of our eyes. People are actually standing up now, not just women, but men too, to a certain degree. Obviously not as much as women are. Where do you think this is going to go with us? Or where would you like to see it go with us?
Yeah.
It would actually be the right question
to ask. Yeah, I would have to say that to answer the first one, where do I think it's going to go? I would have to say that I have a little bit of concern about where I think it might go in that it might get worse for both men and women before it gets better, because I think we're trying to find our way, both genders finding a way to, because we had rules before, we had structures, they didn't work for everybody, but we had them, and so now we're creating a new rule book, and I think while we're creating that new rule book, there's going to be rules broken, and there's going to be people who have their own rule book and think it's the right rule book, and other people have their rule book and think it's the right one. And so I think it's going to take some time to kind of sort that through. I hope that then once we work that through, that we have some really good dialogue, that all these things are put on the table, and that ultimately what we come out with is much healthier relationships, both between men and women, and between heterosexual and homosexual or gay or lesbian, and that we just all come to a place where we understand how to deal with other people as human beings and respect them. Because I don't think that's been happening, you know? Even though we've had the structure in place, a civil society really hasn't always been all that civil, you know?
No, not at all.
It looks like it on the outside, but not when you scratch the surface.
And media doesn't help either, because they paint a picture that was really not true.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And you know, they talk about, you know, fake news. Well, God, I think we've been living under fake news as long as I can remember.
Yeah, I agree.
In regards to, you know, keeping up the Joneses, or maybe not keeping up the Joneses, but being as happy as Brady Bunch or the family or the Parks family, or, I, you know, I'm just...
The Cosbys.
The Cosbys, you know, which are all bad examples now, because in light of society being the way they are now, all these people are being prosecuted or being prosecuted. I'm not saying all of them, but some anyway, right? So it's really hard to draw value from something that's supposed to give you an example of value.
Right.
And now that's all changed around now. So, you know, when you talk about the dimensions of, you know, a man and a woman, and what we're brought to believe in, and what's happening now, it's just totally off the map. So, and I love what you said. We're basically going to be starting right from the beginning, I think, again.
Right. Which is a good thing. It's a good thing. If we can throw all of the other stuff that didn't work,
and
we can kind of just look at it with fresh eyes and say, okay, you know, how do we make this work? The part of the problem of doing that, though, is that it's hard to completely throw out the old.
That's right.
So it keeps creeping back in. But I do, I am encouraged overall, but I think there might be some rough seas ahead. Between where we are now and where we ultimately can get.
You know, when I think of the struggles that women got to get to where they are now, and it's just unfortunate the way it all turned out. I mean, I'm kind of glad to be alive and be the age that I am, because I've seen a lot of this stuff come through the, you know, like the 70s and the 60s, and where women were trying to make change. I mean, granted, I wasn't around the turn of the century where women were trying to vote, as for example. And now, here we are, 2018, and we're talking about men being abused by women.
Right.
Like, talk about a total, like, 100 years plus, just like that. And now we're talking about that. So, you know, I really hope in the future that things will, at least, if anything, I hope we start talking better to one another a little bit better about what these issues are on both sides. And I guess really when it comes right down to it, it's all going to start in schools. We need to start someplace. I mean, yes, obviously in the home, but they need to be taught that in the schools, that it's not our right to do that to either side.
Right. Yeah.
You know, not just sexual abuse is what I'm talking about, but, you know, when you're in a relationship, you know, I look at the churches and the ones that offer marriage counseling, or, right, you go and do this marriage course before you go to the marriage course. I think they need to revamp that stuff too. As an example, you know, you're gonna go, well, I won't go that far, but I mean, just the fact that they're, you know, how can they teach them about marriage when they've never been married?
Right.
So I'm trying to wrap my head around that title. So you're gonna talk to people about the sanctities of marriage, and yet you've never been married. So how can you pass on your wisdom in marriage, or wisdom on marriage, when you've never been married before? So a lot of these things need to be relooked at, but I guess I'm not going to get into that now. But you know, I kind of wanted to ask these questions because I see through social media, I hear lots of ranting and not really any discussion in regards to what are we supposed to be talking about?
Right.
What direction are we supposed to be going? You know, if I could use Adam and Eve as an example, when they both came to the world together, well, we've been together ever since then. If I use that as an analogy, it doesn't mean that everything was right. But we're here, we're brought in together as a team, is what I'm trying to say.
Right.
So my message would be, well, if we're brought in as a team, then I would think that we should be acting as a team. Not one greater than the other, but equal.
Right, yeah. And for me, part of that is, and I know that, you know, there are differences between men and women, physical differences, biological differences, conditioned by society differences. But this goes not just to gender, but to other, other races, cultures. Yeah, is that if we can see other people as people, and not as a woman or a man or this or that, the identity, they call it identity politics. I don't like that word, but the idea is that we're people. And so I think at some point in time, if the discussion can get around to how do we deal with other people and see other people as people and not as whatever we think their identity is. And even to the identity of someone who is an abuser or someone who's experienced abuse, you know, I don't want to be seen as that person, but I do want to be seen as the person that I am. And that's part of who I am, you know, but I don't want to be labeled with that. So I think the labeling of people is a challenge for us as well.
I was speaking with Michael Healy from the Canadian Center of Men and Families. And I should have said that a few times, but we are getting close to our time. And is there anything else you would really would like to add in regards to the Canadian Center that people should know about?
Yeah, I actually have a list of services that I would like to speak to that the center provides. And again, they're all free of charge. I'm not involved with most of them other than the domestic abuse program, but let me just read off my list here of other things. So, as I said, they provide one-on-one therapy and counseling, and that's for men just generally. It doesn't have to be, you don't have to be in a domestic violence situation. Men who've been alienated from their children, men who've had health issues, PTSD, all kinds of different things, their counseling is available to them. There's also a men's peer support group, and this is a group just for men. It's a peer group. It's drop-in, so it's not a closed group. Happens every Thursday night at the center, so anybody can come in. There's a legal assistance clinic that happens on Monday nights. That one you have to register for, but it's free, and you can just show up. And I think they alternate one Monday night. It's about where you get free legal advice from lawyers about family court. And then the other night is about criminal. So one week it's family, next week it's criminal. So there's another program, which is a group that meets. It's called Fathering After Separation or Divorce. And it's really a program for men, giving them skills in how to father their children. When they're doing it on their own, and how to, there's a lot of discussion in that group also is how to co-parent as well, and how to deal with another parent, and all the issues that get, you know, that come up in that sort of situation, and there's a lot of them. There's a domestic abuse program that we talked about. They have, I believe it's on Saturdays, a mindful meditation for men that happens at the center. And again, if you call the center or go on the website, you can get more details on all of these. There's a men, masculinity, and gender discussion group, which is a little bit about what we're talking about, how men are feeling like they fit into society these days, and that's an open room. It happens, I think, maybe every second or third Saturday, that men just get together and talk about, you know, what it's like to be a man in today's society and how to move forward. There's resource assistance and consultation. There's employment. Oh, I just said that. There's they do a guest lecture series regularly, either at usually at the U of T, occasionally at York University. There's a mentorship program for boys and young men. There's men's personal support group counseling program. There's another program that I don't have on my list that's for men who have been falsely accused. It's a support group because that happens as well.
It does.
And there's a whole cluster of you know, impacts when that happens. Men have been falsely accused, so there's a program for that. And then the other big project that's on the go right now is that we're in the process of raising funds to open Toronto's first shelter for abused men, because there are no shelter beds in Toronto and very few in Canada for men who have been abused, and almost none for men and their families. So if a man wants to leave a relationship where their partner is abusive and take the children with them, there's nowhere for them to go right now that is, nowhere that is supported or free. So the Canadian Centre for Men and Families is in the process of fundraising for that. I think they're about 80% on their way to their goal. And hopefully within, you know, the next year, that shelter can be opened in Toronto.
Wow, that would be really awesome.
That would be huge, yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
That's fantastic. So I really appreciate you coming in here. I mean, this is one thing I kind of was talking a little bit briefly before we even got on here that nobody really talks about. Actually, nobody really talks about it. I've seen it. I see it on social media only to certain levels, you know, and but not to this discussion like we've had here. Like nothing this level.
Yeah.
I haven't noticed anyway, or I've missed it, or I just haven't seen it.
Right.
My point. And I'd love again for you to come back on again and talk about this, because I know it's one thing that while we've been here and on Priorscope and on Blog Talk, my mobile has been going off like crazy. It's been ringing.
Yeah.
So I haven't been able to, if there's anybody had any questions, I've not been able to answer because we've been doing Periscope. Folks, if you're listening, this is what's going on. So I'm doing Periscope through my phone or my mobile device, and I have my Blog Talk radio through my desktop. So I don't have another device here. If there was anybody had any questions, do that. So what I think I'm going to do right now is I'm going to sign off Periscope. I'm going to take a quick look on Twitter to see if there is any questions, so that I can answer. So
I'm gonna sign off on
Periscope.
So good night, folks. Thank you for watching Periscope.
Good night. Thank you.
Good night.
And
okay, folks. That was the repodcast from April 12th, 2018, which would have been two Thursdays ago past. So I really hope you enjoyed that interview with Michael. As you found, it was Michael is very very informative, and is very aware of what's going on in the community and abroad. So he's very informed, and absolute pleasure talking with him. As you heard from our conversation, I am planning on having him come back, but I think I'm going to go a little bit further and organize a Q&A so other men can get in the conversation with us as well. That is if you feel you can. But anyway, this opportunity will be there. And I don't think I'd make it gender-based. I would really encourage any men that do or would like to talk about this. And, of course, you can by the realm of social media, you can ask these questions and still be anonymous, is my point, if you're worried about who people finding out who you are. But if you're not and you don't care and you just want to find out and you want help, well, this is the place to come. But anyway, I'm going to have him come back in September, in the fall, and I will let you know in advance so that when you do come back, you may have questions prepared ready for him. If you're willing and would like so. So, folks, I'm going to sign off. I will be back in two more nights, Thursday, and I will have another guest, another survivor. I think you will really enjoy hearing our conversation. Actually, the gentleman's name will be John Nikas. He is a survivor and facilitator at the Gatehouse as well. And it'd be nice hearing from another man's perspective, especially on the side of the effects of childhood sexual abuse, the ordeal that he went through in his healing process, his story. So I think you'll find John very well. You'll like John, just like I do. Folks, I'm going to sign off. Good night. Take care of yourselves, self-care, and I'll see you on Thursday. Good night.